Back over you, Dick, WJTB. And I think you said your mother is in Queens, which is quite close to the transmitter, way out here in Huntington. And Dix Hills, where I live, Dix Hills has got something like 25 square miles, 26,000 people. I can drive up and down every one of those streets, and there's only one human being in Dix Hills that has an operating television aerial that is using over-the-air reception now that there is digital television. Everyone else has given up and is going over the cable, satellite, and everything else. The good news about digital television is that we were promised it would have the exact same range that we had with analog television. Not true. And it's extremely vulnerable to multipass. When digital television works, it gives you a beautiful snow-free picture. But the difference between the signal strength that gives you a good snow-free picture and the signal strength that gives you nothing, a locked-up picture, no audio, and most of the time no video, is one decibel of change. If you slowly crank the signal generator, cranking a signal, like a digital signal into your television set, let me drop it. And you watch what happens as you turn down the amplitude of that signal generator. As you hit the threshold, and you go 1 dB beyond, the beautiful snow-free picture goes to nothing. Extreme, sharp, hard, cliff threshold. That's just signal strength. And when it comes to multipath, getting a reflection off of anything in the neighborhood, you're going to, in many cases, get a fair amount of grief with digital television. It's very vulnerable to multipath. As such, although it sounds crazy, even though you're super close, you've got a window, you've got a rooftop antenna on digital television, there is a huge advantage in putting a rotator on that television aerial. Of course it sounds crazy. Hey, I've got line of sight to Empire State Building. Why the hell do I need a rotator? All I got to do is aim the antenna at the Empire State Building, right? No. If you've got a rotator, and as the leaves on the trees get wet, and the leaves move a little bit, the tree is growing, each individual day as you rotate that antenna, if you really plotted the real pattern of a television aerial, you'd like to think it's a nice, simple, cucumber-shaped pattern, if you plotted it in a conventional manner, no way in hell. Real television aerials got bumps and grinds all over the place in their antenna pattern. And therefore, even though you've got line of sight to Empire State Building, you do a gentle amount of rotating of that television aerial with your very inexpensive $50, $30, whatever it is, antenna rotator. All of a sudden, the multipath coming into those various notches of the antenna pattern get better, get worse, and you'll find a very specific direction to aim the antenna today where you get beautiful, clean, digital television reception when you do that rotating. Opposite of common sense. So if she's willing to put in a rotator, a hell of a lot of that grief will probably disappear a good percentage of the time, Joe. Also, one other question I got for you. Let me drop it. If Bill hasn't already done it, and I'm talking about Bill Burns, your neighbor in your town, not very far from you, we'll try to talk him into putting any kind of an antenna on the roof of his house, any kind of a coat hanger wired antenna, but by that extra altitude, he's going to get 20 decibels more signal, whether he talks to the eastern input or the western input. So I'd like you to give a couple of hints to your nearby neighbor, Bill, to convince him, if he hasn't already done so, to create some kind of a 2-meter antenna at a slightly higher altitude. WJ2B, KQRIW, you got it, Joe.
WJ2B. Are you talking about the guy that was by Smithtown Boulevard and Nichols Road, and he was like at low altitude there?
I'm not sure, but I think his call letters are AC2IS. If that's the one, his name is Bill. He lives in your town with you. Go ahead, Joe.
We should get him, he should have bought one of Bruce's old towers. I think they were trying to sell it. I saw on, I think it was on Craigslist, somebody listed Bruce's old towers from his QTH there, and I think one of them is gone. I think they sold one of them, but yeah, I haven't talked to him in quite a while, AC2IS. I don't know how often he gets on, but yeah, I know he was having trouble. Actually, where he is located is actually a flood-prone area over there. That's like one of the lowest elevations in my particular area. And I know that by the flooding, I've seen them pumping water out of the streets and the storm drains in that area. I used to see pump trucks there with hoses going all over the place, and that's a flooding problem over there. And I know from using the 449-125 in the mobile, if I drive into that area, I have trouble even making that 449 repeater from my car. It's like in a valley over there, basically. I'm actually on a hill here. Where I am is about 120 feet above sea level, and everywhere you go away from my house here, everything goes downhill. So, it's kind of weird that, when I bought this house, I wasn't even a ham, so I wasn't even thinking of altitude. I just got lucky that I'm on a little bit of a hill here. But, where he is definitely a problem. And, my mom, like you said, a rotator would probably be really good. Probably, like you said, the best direction to put the antenna might not be pointed right at the transmitter. It might be 90 degrees to the left and to the right. You get the best signal because you don't really need to maximize the signal as much as you need to minimize the multipath. So rotator would be a good idea. It's a very good suggestion. Back over to you, WJC.
Guarantee it would make a huge improvement for your mother's situation. And now let me tell you the most severe situation that I saw along these lines. I was at the KE2EJ, Eric's place of business, at his belt broadcast transmitter, Channel 21 in Plainview. And his television reception aerial, for when he receives the New York City station, is mounted on that radio tower. I don't know how far, maybe it's 100 feet above the ground. But he's got a hilltop location, at least 100 feet, if not more, of tower where the television aerial is mounted, and the rotator on it. And he was looking at the quality of the television digital signal reception he was getting during the time that I was there witnessing this. And I watched him rotate that antenna on that tower with twice line of sight, if you know what I mean, to empire. And I watched the signal strength, and I watched, not signal, I watched the, what is it called now? Bit error rate of the digital signal reception improved as he rotated that antenna in that most ideal location. And I said, wow, that is really telling us something. Mother Nature is giving us an extremely strong message. The good news about digital television is that the less power to transmit it is required. It's supposed to get the same range, and everything's supposed to be hunky-dory, always snow-free. On paper, it sounds beautiful. It didn't come out quite that nice in the real world. Mother Nature is a little bit nasty when it comes to multipath and the inter-symbol distortion you get when a high-speed, very complicated digital signal experiences multipath, and therefore you're getting the signal directly real fast, indirectly a little bit slow, and you slide in time those two digital pulse trains, and all of a sudden the pluses and minuses of the pulses overlap each other. And then you ask that poor digital converter to figure out what the hell is going on. And periodically he says, I give up. He gives you a
repeater. Time out.
The digital television reception will tell you weak signal. It doesn't measure signal strength. It measures bit error rate, and it plots that as signal strength. So it tells you weak signal. It really means that the direct signal is not strong enough above all the other indirect signals. Therefore, the signal-to-noise ratio is too low, and therefore the bit error rate is high, and it reports it as weak signal. 90-some-odd percent of the time, the signal is not weak. It is corrupted, and the thing can't tolerate it. Now, as you get to more and more modern television sets with more and more elaborate digital converters, with the so-called wake receiver function built into it, more and more computer processing, the amount of tolerance it has of multipath, inter-symbol distorted, corrupted signals, the amount of tolerance increases somewhat so that a more modern set can tolerate more of that. Are we ever going to get back to the full performance we used to have with analog television, where a person with a rooftop antenna in a slightly good location in Southampton could watch a slightly snowy television picture which was acceptable to him? The poor guy in Southampton getting over-the-air television reception, he's two or three times beyond the range of digital television, even though he used to have analog television. So no matter what you say, we've lost a little bit. We gain something in quality of the picture when it's there, but my goodness, the number of things in my neighborhood that when local transmitters turn on, my television reception goes down the tubes. So I'm convinced that digital television is a hell of a lot more vulnerable. Okay, Joe, good luck with those projects, and again, whatever you find, please come back and report it to us. Now, of the people who did sign in, some of them have got called away temporarily. You know who you are. Give me your call letters right now with your question. K2IW in the TechNet. Okay. My guess is very close to Wheeling, West Virginia right now is K2 UPS, K2 Uncle Papa Sierra. Rich, are you there? And did I guess that you've just gone to Wheeling, West Virginia? K2 UPS, mobile, K2IW in the TechNet.
I'm in Pennsylvania now for a little bit of distance, but not a bad ride tonight, and it's been interesting that so far.
Very fine, Rich. I made a guess you would be there. And yes, at the beginning of the TechNet, you were approaching Wheeling. You've already gone through that, and you've gone probably past Philadelphia. And you passed that guy, I think it's K3LELA, the guy with a zillion 200-foot-high towers on his multi-acre of property. Unfortunately, you passed that tonight in the dark. You didn't get a chance to see it, but you know it's there. I bet you're looking forward to the day when you can stop and really eyeball that equipment, Rich. K2UPS for a final on that one. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, that's the key page to K3LR, Lima Radio. But that's up on I-80, right on the Pennsylvania-Ohio border. And I'm down on I-70 right now. So, a couple miles away from it. And even though it's tall, I don't think I can see it from this this location. So. But I'll see that again in 2 weeks when I come back. K2UPS.
Very fine, Rich. I'm glad you reminded me. If you really want to see some serious antennas, simply QRZ.com. Go to K3 Lima Romeo. Go to K3 Lima Romeo. Start reading his biography. Start going to his website. Start looking at his photographs. Man, that is a ham radio operation. I think he's got in the vicinity of 200 people who will visit him during a particular HF contest and adjust his antennas, do operating. I think he's got about 10 different transmitters he can run simultaneously. Probably 6 major towers, a zillion antennas. That's serious ham radio. So take a look at that and that drool. K3 Lima Romeo. John, KC2WGB, what have you seen so far on the your internet monitoring of the Echolink signals? And I know you've been getting, as usual, some of these geniuses that don't yet have their ham license that write to you because of the mailbag, so to speak. What kind of questions are they giving you to stump us tonight? And if you told them they all get this great big prize if they stump us again, KC2WGB, KQRIW in the TechNet, you got it, John.
KZF, my frequency.
Very fine, Vito. Vito, semi-minute joke. Vito, did we skip over you? I don't think you signed in earlier. Vito, go right ahead. KQRIW in the TechNet.
No, I did not sign in. Just a stupid question, and to do with technology. But in my imagination, or there was no TechNet last Sunday. Is that correct? Go ahead.
Oh, no, there was definitely a TechNet last Sunday. In fact, I went to the website of amateurradio.tangovictor, and last week's 4 hours of TechNet, I listened to that recording. Yeah, I'm pretty vain, and I found a number of places where I said things backwards, these spoonerisms, as I usually say. So, not only was there a TechNet, there's a full recording of it you can play back, and I did just that, Vito. Right back to you, Vito. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay. I was looking at the clock on the wall. It was 8:25 p.m. Sunday. I believe last Sunday was Father's Day. And I said, where's the TechNet? And I was listening on this frequency and heard nothing. So, The radio was turned on. Okay, it was my imagination. I was stretching things, so I do apologize. Thank you so much for letting me be recognized. And good evening to you, John. WA2PJFC.
And Vito, I know that you're quite a fan. Vito periodically calls me the professor. It's a very nice compliment. I'm not a professor. I try to act like one. But all is not lost. That recording is there. You can play it back fast, slow, skip through the good parts and the bad parts and so on. So you didn't lose anything. And so I know that on one occasion I thought my receiver was on 146.85. It was on 146.805, and I missed that. And therefore, I was wondering why I wasn't hearing things. There's probably a good explanation. When you find out, I'd like to know about it. So, John, go ahead with those mailbags and also tell us what you see on the EchoLink website tonight. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the second act. You got it, John.
We've had between 8 and 10 participating on EchoLink, and one message over chat. So it's a little quiet, but no questions on either one right now. I do have some questions, but I think we should let it go for a full drop and reset, make sure we haven't lost the stimulus, and make sure everything else is getting set up. So back to you, Tim.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. I just checked, and the Eastern Link has been timed out. So we're going to go for a full drop. Stand by, everybody. Okay, in theory, everything's been reset. Nope. I'm very disappointed. Because the Eastern Link, I'm not hearing it. So anybody who has control of the Eastern Link might have to go through a procedure to reset it. I know there are some guys out east that only hear us by way of the 147.375, and right now it is not repeating us. I'm going to go for one more full drop and try again.
Hey, let me see what I can do. Dick, WB2, OMW.
Very fine, Bob. Thank you. Yeah, I'm not hearing the Eastern Link, but we've tried to reset it, John, and looks like Bob's working on it, so hopefully our solution's on the way. KC2WGB, give us a little bit more audio, John. KC2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, how's that take better?
That's just about the perfect amplitude.
Very good. I just had to remember what mic I'm supposed to be speaking into. All right. By the way, let me say hello to Vito. He's always welcome. Interesting gentleman. And do you want to try to pick up Bernie one more time before we start?
By the way, if you could see John's studio, he's got a number of these broadcast quality microphones. I think he's got two or three of them connected to various rigs. He's got to make sure he talks into the right mic at the right time. Poor guy, he's down to his last three or four mics and audio processing networks. Brady, K2 Yankee Oscar, are you there? K2RIW in the TechNet. I did hear earlier tonight that you're going to be giving us a report about a Mac hookup.
Mesh.
You've now seen evidence of what I do, John. I don't remember words. I remember concepts. Mac and mesh. You can see what the mental image I had of that. Okay, maybe Bernie will be joining us later. KC2WGB, go right ahead with the mailbag. KC2RIW.
Okay, Dick. I have a young amateur here who's asking questions about frequency and reflectivity of different products. Mainly interested in glass between 10 gig and 100 gig. What passes through, what is reflected? And then his next question is, would it be equal if it was plexiglass or Lexan? So we'll go for just unleaded window glass, number one. and then switch it over to plexiglass if there's a difference. Maybe you can give him some guidance in some place you can go to research that information also. So over to you, Dick, and this is KC2WGB.
35. I'm checking on the Eastern Link. It's still not there, I'm sorry to say. All right. The amount of reflection you get off of insulated objects, something that amazes the hell out of people. I got a very nice award because of the work I did at the world's largest anechoic chamber way back in the dark ages of 1989 at Edwards Air Force Base, the Manyfield Anechoic Facility. It's a 300-foot square chamber, 7 stories high, fully shielded room. Put a whole great big B-1 airplane in there, B-1B bomber, rotated and squirt signals at it and measure its quality. And they had set up wooden support structures in 3 corners of the room, supporting antennas to squirt signals at the airplane from 150 feet away, 170 feet away. And they had
you are currently connected to node number 9126.
By default, open F10 able.
Okay, I'm going to do a little bit of checking. Nope. The Eastern Link is still not on. So, after a whole lot of testing as to what was going wrong in the chamber, they were getting echoes they didn't want to get. These wooden structures that were supporting a whole bunch of antennas in 3 corners of the room were built with 4x4 pieces of wood with wooden pegs in order to be low in reflectivity. And when a 10 gigahertz signal hits those chunks of wood, you get a reflection off the chunks of wood that's only a couple of decibels weaker than a chunk of steel at the same size. Of course that sounds crazy. Wood is an insulator. How in the world can you get a radio reflection off of it? Well, you transmit a microwave signal into free space with a free space impedance of 377 ohms. That signal wants to see nothing but 377. If it sees any other impedance, it's a little bit equivalent to having a piece of 50-ohm transmission line, coax cable, and you suddenly make a transition to a 100-ohm transmission line. You've got, in theory, a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio because you suddenly made an abrupt change of the impedance. You're going to get a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio out of that, the reflection off of that transition. You change the medium the signal is propagating through in the form of that coax. All right, that chunk of wood has got a dielectric constant of 3.5. Compared to air, that signal hits the wood and reflects off of it. If that chunk of wood was the exact same size as a chunk of plexiglass or Lexan, which also has a dielectric constant in that vicinity, you're going to get an echo off of it. So just because of dielectric, even before you talk about any kind of conductivity, even before you talk about aluminizing the glass or whatever, the fact that it has what the optical people call refractive index, what we radio people call dielectric constant, and the
repeater, timeout.
So to repeat, the optical people call it refractive index of glass. Each individual kind of glass has got its refractive index. And something very closely related to that is what we radio people call dielectric constant. They're fairly close, but there's a little difference. And so because of the difference in dielectric constant, you're going to get a reflection off of a chunk of material. How much reflection you get is a function of how many wavelengths thick. Even though your particular piece of glass might have a very high refractive index, might have a very high dielectric constant of 4-to-1, and you would say, boy, I'm going to get a huge reflection off of that. If the chunk of glass is thin compared to wavelength, if it's a 16th of a wavelength thick, and you're using it as a radome, now study with your Smith chart and your formulas by which you can do it. If I had a piece of 50-ohm coax cable, and I now marry it to a piece of 100-ohm coax cable, but that 100-ohm coax cable is only a tenth of a wavelength long, and then I transition back to 50-ohm coax cable, I got this little bit of a bump in the transmission line where I've got a small chunk of 100-ohm cable in my particular example, or it could be 20-ohm cable, if you know what I mean. A big change in impedance, but it's only there for a tenth of or a 20th of a wavelength. And you study what happens on a Smith chart or the formulas where you really make the measurement. And you'll find out that the amount of perturbation is very small. craziness. That's the way you build a radome over a radar antenna. That's a so-called thin skin design. You can get away with murder with dielectric constant of the materials you use for the weatherproofing radome over your radar antenna, as long as you can keep it thin compared to wavelength. So, knowing the number of wavelengths, and by the way, let me drop. That is also the method of operation of the quarter wave coupling plate that you can put on materials where you want the signal to go through without reflection. You put a quarter wave coupling plate, you put a certain thickness of material of just the right dielectric constant in front of your glass, in front of your plexiglass, in front of your Lexan. You can make all of the signal go through at that particular frequency. That is exactly what's happening with the optical coating you put on binocular glasses and lenses of cameras. That bluish-looking material that's on the front is a quarter-wave coupling plate. So that if now I had to, if I've got a 100-ohm antenna and I've got a 50-ohm coax cable, and if I put a quarter-wave length of something like 69-ohm coax, if I take 100 ohms, multiply it by 50, and take the square root of that, if I put, and it's going to be something around 69 ohms, if I put a piece of 69 ohm coax cable exactly one quarter wavelength long at the end of my 50 ohm cable going into my 100 ohm antenna, at that frequency, I get a perfect impedance match. It's called a quarter wave coupling plate. The optical equivalent of that is the coating you put on lenses. So that the bottom line of all this, let me drop. The bottom line of all this is that any dielectric constant you put in front of that antenna, the leaves of a tree, by the way, a whole bunch of forests of trees, when you're trying to send your radio signal from the mountaintop, from one mountaintop to another, and it has to skip across the top of a bunch of forests of trees in between, you think they're going to be transparent, or you'd be amazed how reflective they are. And you're getting multipath from that situation. So in many situations where you have to go through some particular material, where you cannot lower its dielectric constant. So one place where you can is that if you want to support an antenna and you buy this very low-density foam made by the Emerson Cummings Company, where they also make radar-absorbing material, they give you this very low-density foam at 2 pounds per cubic foot. It's got a dielectric constant of something like 1.02, something very low. It's very close to air. Just so happens the foam that you buy at Home Depot that you place as foam insulation between the rafters of your house happens to be the exact same stuff. You don't have to pay $1 zillion per square foot to buy it from Emerson Cummings. You can buy it from Home Depot. And so the support structures I use to hold antennas up in the air on the anechoic range that I set up for the work that I've done for the last 10 years, I use that foam to support these microwave antennas at 900 megacycles. And the antenna thinks it's in free air, if you know what I mean. So in that case, you control the dielectric constant, even though you're trying to support the antenna, by using very low-density foam. But if you've got to go through glass, and you can't change the thickness of the glass, you can't change the dielectric in the glass, you could put a coating of material in front of the glass and behind the glass to make the transmissivity go to 100% at the normal angle if you want to. And what do you do at other angles? Life gets a little bit more complicated, but know there is a way around it. And now all of a sudden you're going to discover, let me drop, that the hell of a lot of the things that we microwave engineers need to do, if we're smart enough to study what the optical people have been doing for years. Let me show you why the optical people are smarter than us in one respect. Many of us who are on 440 megacycles, we don't think we're going to get a nosebleed because we go up so high in frequency to 440, to use a 440 repeater. We've got a gut feel as to what 600 megacycles is. We've got a warm feeling. If somebody told us the transmitter is not running at 440, it's running at 600 megacycles, it wouldn't alarm us, particularly if you're a 1296 ham radio operator. So we've got a good feeling for what is 600 megahertz. Okay, you take 600 megahertz, multiply it by 1 million in frequency. That is the center of the optical band where your eye works. It's the exact same electromagnetic spectrum, the exact same kind of signal. We move it higher in frequency, and we call it light. It's the exact same stuff. And what those guys have up, what those guys have figured out what to do with lenses and prisms and whatever, we have the ability to do that in slightly larger scale down at our frequency that is 1 million times lower. It's the exact same spectrum. We're just using another end of it. KC2WGZ, K2LAW in effect net.
Hey, Terry Jack.
Go right ahead, Eric.
You know, let John finish up. I have a quick question for you. Maybe you can provide me with a little insight.
Okay, as you give me your question, please send me enough audio.
All right, I'm working on a Tesla. It's a big transmitter. Anyway, when I give it drive, the screen starts to go negative, and that's without any screen voltage. What do you think?
There's a name for it. It's called secondary emission. Should I describe what secondary emission is, or would I bore you with that one, Eric? Go ahead.
No, I'm aware of it. Go ahead for the other people.
My favorite tube where I see this effect is my 4CX250B tube, and I've used them for zillions of hours on the so-called parallel kilowatt transmitter, tip line parallel kilowatt for 432. April and May 1972 QST. If you're an AR or L member, and you go to the archives, and you look up April and May 1972, part one and part two of this article, this 4CX250B used on a strip line amplifier, a pair of those tubes in parallel, give you 700 watts of output on 432 with 1,000 watts in, very close to 70% efficiency. When you're operating those tubes on that band in that manner, 2,000 volts on the plate, 300 volts on the screen grid, minus 90 volts on the control grid because you're using Class C FM operation, that's the way I did it. Under those conditions, that tube will crank out 700 watts. As you adjust the tuning and loading of the plate circuit on that strip line amplifier, that strip line amplifier, even though it's way up at a microwave frequency, it has the tuning and loading control as if it was a Pi network at 80 meters. So I can control whether or not the tube sees a high impedance or low impedance, above resonance or below resonance. I've got complete control of those two knobs on the front panel of that transmitter. I can tell that tube what impedance it's going to see. And when I do that, I see a very interesting experiment. Let me drop. What I've discovered after lots of years of use of that tube is that when the tube is in resonance and lightly loaded, the screen grid starts running very positive in current. When the tube is heavily loaded and in resonance, the screen grid starts running negative in current. I'm putting 300 volts positive on the screen grid, and the screen grid runs negative in current by 10 milliamperes. The screen grid is acting like a battery. It's acting like a 310-volt battery when I'm putting a 300-volt power supply under the screen grid. It is pumping my power supply. How the hell does it do that? And the answer is, when the tube is heavily loaded, which really means that the amount of voltage swing on the plate is smaller because I put a heavier load on it. As such, when the positive pulse of voltage on the control grid creates a great big cloud of electrons leaving the control grid, swishing through that screen grid, and going toward the plate, a certain number of those electrons impact the screen grid. When they impact the screen grid, they create secondary emission. Some of those electrons hit the screen grid wire. One electron hits the wire, and two electrons bounce off of it. At that instant of time, the two electrons are seeing the heavily loaded plate, which has a small RF voltage swing, so there's probably at least 1,000 volts left on that plate, and those two electrons say, boy, I see that great big positive plate a fraction of an inch away, and they go flying over there. So now look what's happening. Each electron that hits that screen grid at that instant time creates two electrons that are broken loose in my example, and the two electrons leave the screen grid and go toward the plate. More electrons are leaving.
Repeater, time out.
More electrons are leaving than enter the screen grid. That's called negative current. The bottom line of all that's called secondary emission. The magic of all this is that when you adjust the tube for maximum power output and maximum efficiency, the screen grid current goes toward zero. The positive screen grid current, you know that the tube is too heavily loaded. You see negative screen grid current, I got it backwards. You see, too heavily loaded, you see negative current. Too lightly loaded, you see positive current. When the tube is very lightly loaded, the voltage swing on the plate becomes very large. Therefore, at the instant that the screen, the Class C mode operation, positive voltage on the control grid gives you a cloud of electrons going by. Because the voltage on the plate is such a big swing, now, at the instant that cloud of electrons hits the screen grid, at that instant, the plate voltage is going through zero. The electrons that get boiled off of two electrons, they don't see that high positive voltage on the plate. They don't go anywhere. They jump back to the screen grid. Therefore, you only have entering electrons. You have no leaving electrons. And you see positive screen current. You see positive screen current, you know that the tube is too heavily, is too lightly loaded. So you can tell immediately, is the tube happy with the amount of loading by watching that screen grid current? You're really watching the modulation of the secondary emission of the screen grid. KQEJ, I bet you got some words you want to add to this one there, Eric. KQRIW in the second hand.
K2IW, K2K. Let me feed you a little bit of information on what I'm doing. And tell me what I'm doing wrong. Alright, this, by the way, is a 4CX3500. Alright. The plate voltage here is about 4750 volts. Alright. I'm starting off with the screen grid at zero. Alright. 0 volts. And the grid voltage is about minus 220. Okay. Now, the idea is to, tune the input control, the grid control, until it's resonant, so the grid starts drawing current. Then the idea is to try and find resonance with the floating and the tuning control. I never get that point, which is, you know, it's the broadcast sensor, and if it sees negative voltage coming off the screen, goes into a safety mode. It'll start off with no drive and everything will be fine. It starts to increase the drive, tune the grid to the maximum current, which is about 15, 20 volts at this point. If I go any higher than that, the screen starts to go negative. The protection circuit sensor just says, what do you think, Dick?
You gotta be careful on what you're doing there, Eric. You're using the tube out of its normal envelope, so to speak. The most dangerous thing you can do with a tetrode tube, I'm gonna relate tetrode to your particular tube and you'll see why. The most dangerous thing you can do to a tetrode tube is to have a nice stiff power supply with 300 volts on the screen grid of a 4CX250B. You're applying normal amount of drive to the control grid, normal bias on the control grid. So the control grid is creating great big cloud of electrons periodically leaving the control grid, going toward the screen grid that's sitting there at plus 300 volts. And of all those electrons that leave the cathode control grid, go toward the screen grid, you want them, a few of them are always going to be intercepting the screen grid, giving you some positive screen grid current, and you want the majority of them to fly through the screen grid and go toward that positive plate voltage to do its thing on the plate. If you leave the screen grid voltage on, plus 300 volts in the case of a 250V, and if for some reason you lose the 2,000 volts power supply on the plate, of all those electrons that are capable of creating a quarter or a half an ampere of plate current, all those electrons that have left the cathode that would have gone to the plate would have created a pulse of plate current of 500 or 1,000 milliampere, almost an ampere. The plate voltage ain't there. Therefore, all of that current gets sucked up by the screen grid, and in about 4 seconds, the screen grid becomes overheated. It can't tolerate more than 12 watts, and you're about to put 500 watts into that screen grid. You're going to burn it up instantaneously. So, in the case of lack of plate voltage, the screen grid there, and you're not monitoring the screen grid current with a protection circuit, you can burn up that screen grid in a couple of seconds. Now, let me jump back a step. under normal circumstances of the
repeater. Timeout.
Of the normal voltage you're putting on the control grid for drive. Periodically, that control grid is being driven into some pretty fierce positive voltage in order to suck a great big chunk of electrons out of that cathode. And those electrons sucked out of that cathode, you want them to fly through the control grid and see that positive screen grid, get sucked up by the screen grid, and proceed on toward the plate. But you've made the screen grid voltage zero. Therefore, that great big positive voltage. Therefore, that great big positive voltage on the screen grid ain't there. And if you're not carefully monitoring control grid current, because now the electrons have nowhere to go, you can easily overdo dissipate that control grid. I can tell you're monitoring control grid, you know what the maximum control grid current is, therefore you're calculating control grid dissipation and your protection. So the protection network on the screen grid, whenever it sees current flowing in the wrong direction or too much current, that protection network is going to put you into some kind of a standby mode. So a real good protection network on a screen grid looks for over negative current and it goes into a protection. Over positive current and it goes into a protection. Over negative current is dangerous because if the screen grid power supply doesn't have enough bleeder resistor and you start putting negative screen grid current, which really means the screen grid, let me drop it. The screen grid is starting to act like its own battery power supply. And so, in the case of a 4CX250B, you think you're putting 300 volts on the screen grid, and the screen grid starts running negative in current. It's starting to pump your power supply. As such, it is taking your rectifying diodes on that 300 volt power supply and feeding them backwards. In the process of it supplying negative screen current, the screen current can, instead of being the 300 volts you think it is, it can climb to 500 volts. When it does that, the tube that normally will draw 500 milliamps will draw a couple of amperes of plate current because of the 500 volts on the screen grid. Plate current is a function of screen voltage to the 3/8 power. If you didn't have enough bleeder resistor to control your power supply and it's starting to flow toward 500 volts, if you don't have enough protection network in there, the plate will draw so damn much current, it'll blow every fuse you've got in the house. Maybe me, how many guys have done that with a simple little 1,000-watt transmitter called K2LIW Parallel Kilowatt Amplifier. So, got to be a little bit careful here as to what currents flow, how much dissipation they create, what voltages they can pump, and what those voltages can do. You're using the tube out of its normal range, but you don't have that screen voltage on there, and you're going to see some crazy effects, in my opinion, Eric. K2EJ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Hi, Dick. Well, you're not taking into consideration what I'm doing here. Let me just quickly go over what the manufacturer says. Right? There's a IPA that drives the grid of the tube, right? And what they want you to do is to set the exciter at 5 watts, right? Adjust the importunity control, which is the measure of the grid, and obtain maximum indication on the grid meter. Then you adjust the exciter for about 7.5 watts, which will actually make 75 watts as the output of the IPA. And then they want you to adjust the output power and plate current meters until they want you to adjust the output tuning control for maximum output power. And then raise what they call the automatic power control, which is really the screen voltage. And they want you to get it up to about 400 milliamps of plate current. Then adjust the output tuning for maximum power, trim the input tuning for maximum power, you know, maximum grid current, go back and, you know, dip it to. Mike, if you can't get that far.
Okay, it sounds to me like the manufacturer of your transmitter, knowing the characteristics of that tube, has given you a step-by-step procedure to follow. Which one of those steps are giving you a grief, Eric? You said you can't get that far. You described to me 10 steps, and you said I can't get that far. So is it step number 3 or step number 7, and what is that step doing that's giving you the grief, and what are the symptoms of that grief? K2EJ, K2LIW.
All right, I start with a little bit of drive, which would be about 50 watts on the grid.
I go for adjusting the input tuning, and as I get to where maximum is, okay, at when I'm at 5 watts, I can peak it, everything's kosher. You look at this screen grid meter, you can see it's just a slight hair under zero. Then you've got to raise the power a little bit. You know, when I get past 6 watts, it goes into the screen detection. It actually shuts the high voltage down, shuts the filament off. And you can see that the screen grid meter is actually skipping in the wrong direction.
Not enough voltage on the screen.
If the plate voltage is there, and no matter what voltage you put on the screen, you're going to start seeing negative screen current if the plate isn't in resonance and allowed to swing. So negative screen current, opposite normal polarity of screen current, tells me that there is a high positive voltage on the plate, which is sucking off those secondary electrons being released by that screen, and the cloud of electrons from the control grid and cathode are hitting that screen. That's where the secondary emission is coming from. That's where the negative screen current is coming from. The only way you can make that go away is for the plate to be in resonance and allowed to swing, because it's got a light enough loading, in resonance and light enough loading. When the plate is allowed to swing, then that negative screen current will decrease. As I said before, with normal voltages everywhere and normal drive everywhere, the screen grid current, in the case of a 250V, when the loading is too heavy, the screen grid current is negative. When the loading is too light, the screen grid current is positive. So knowing immediately by looking at the screen grid current, you know something about the health of the plate. Is the plate in resonance, and is it properly loaded? By the way, out of resonance is almost the same as being super heavily loaded. The voltage is not allowed to swing on the plate, therefore it's always too positive, therefore you get negative screen current. I wonder if you should skip the step of running 0 volts on the screen and go to the step with real voltage on the screen, because now you're going to be creating a big enough, you're going to be creating a big enough cloud of electrons on each pulse going through the screen toward the plate. The plate will be seeing the normal amount of pulse of plate current, and now with full screen voltage, full strict plate voltage, and proper tuning and loading of the plate, now you're going to have proper plate voltage swing, and you stand a chance of having the proper amount of screen current. And I'm guessing in your case, the screen current is going to be close to zero at maximum power output. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
K2LAW, K2EJ. Actually, the screen current should be about 35 milliamps when it's running properly, and it'll be about 350 volts on the screen. This transmitter got whacked with lightning. Can't imagine how many tips I've changed to any. In terms of the control system, it's been all messed up. But, actually, my, what you just described is really my problem in terms of the plate is not in resonance, okay? This is an FM transmitter designed to go across the whole band. So, the tube that I pulled out, that I don't know if you've ever seen a tube with an open filament. I never have. It's the first time for me. So, I suspect, I mean, unfortunately, it's all hardline that comes out of it, and it's not easy to push like a grid dip meter to at least get close. When you were building your amplifier, how did you get your tuning and loading controls into a zone where you could at least start to see some signal pass through it?
K2RWK, 2J. Yeah, Don, good question, Eric. At 432 megacycles, which was considered a microwave frequency in 1969, 1970, when I was doing this work, because I had this genius of a guy named Hank King, all of a sudden I forgot Hank King's call letters. It'll come to me in a minute. W5TRS is when he became W2, doesn't matter right now. He's a silent key. He taught me very well how supplying the amplifiers work, supplying circuits. So by calculation, I knew very close to the right length, the right capacitances of the flapper capacitors in the right place to hit resonance. So I had calculated where resonance would be. in order to double confirm that, I took the plate of the top of the transmitter, the sheet metal plate, slid it a little bit off to one side so that it was an available crack. In that available crack, I stuck the plastic knob out of a UHF grid dip meter. And the UHF grid dip meter went to, I think, 900 megs. And therefore, I could see resonance at 432. On top of that, by way of slowly creeping up on the voltages and drives on the tube, I could have easily found it under real test conditions. So, in my case, resonance was both a calculation as well as a confirmation with a grid dip meter. But even if I didn't have the calculation, even if I didn't have the grid dip meter, I would know when I hit resonance. If I was far out of resonance and I was turning the tuning and loading controls on the amplifier and I never got a dip, yes, I would have been in trouble. Then I would have had to go back and done a more serious calculation or a more serious a test with the grid dip meter. KQ2EJ, K2LIW.
All right, now the question is, did you have protection circuitry? Because, you know, this protection system is rather sensitive, and that's what's getting in my way. I'm half a mind to defeat it, you know, bypass it for the moment, just until I can find measurements. Unfortunately, the way this tube is, the big tube, it's all encased in a cavity. And it goes into an inch and a half DIA hardline, and I can't get at it. So I'm trying to think of a good way to even come close to resonance. And by the way, the guy that said that there's no voltage on the screen is an issue. Actually, that's not a problem. It's using the screen grid to control the amount of output it'll do. Just when it goes negative, it's a problem. Got any suggestions? K2RW, K2Test.
I'm guessing that 4CX3500 is a pretty expensive tube. I'll bet you that's $3,000 a pop or some number like that. And those protection circuits are in there for a reason. The screen grid is a very powerful control of what the power output of the tube is. That's the good news. But that screen grid, in the case of a 4CX250B, can only tolerate 12 watts. You've got a tube that's capable of cranking 500 watts of output. Got a little screen grid in there that can only tolerate 12 watts, and if the plate voltage suddenly fails, all 500 of those watts can go to that screen grid and burn him up in a second. So those protection circuits are there for a reason. I'd be a little bit slow on bypassing them, Eric, because you'd be putting a multi-$1,000 tube at risk when you do that. As you slowly sneak up on the voltages you do have control of, you will be able to at least approach the point where the controls, where the protection circuits are about to trip out, but back off a little bit from there. Let me drop.
Well, let me give you the maximum rating. The screen voltage maximum in this case is 1500. Maximum grid voltage minus 500. Screen dissipation in this case, maximum 165 watts. Grid maximum 50 watts. So, and by the way, the tube is 4600 bucks.
Yep, I was in the right ballpark, and I said 3,000, so it's 4,600. Okay, I heard something in the vicinity of 150 watts of screen dissipation capability on a tube that's capable of dissipating 3,500 watts on that plate. Therefore, you can very easily hit that 150 watts of screen dissipation without monitoring that screen current and having that protection circuit, so I'd be careful in that one. Now, in your case, resonance is where you're looking for the dip in plate current. That's when you really hit resonance. However, even though you've got this great big airline output going to that from that transmitter to the antenna, there's got to be a way that you can do a little bit of sampling on that transmission line, a directional coupler, a probe, something in that transmission line. And if you put that into a detecting device like a spectrum analyzer, the nice thing about a spectrum analyzer is it's got super sensitivity. You could be a mile away from resonance. But as you start going in the direction of resonance, that super weak signal being picked up by the spectrum analyzer, monitoring what's going on in that great big piece of airline going to the antenna, you'll see the power start to increase. It's a little bit like a blind person walking up a hill. Even though you're nowhere near the top of the hill, you can feel the tilt of the land and you know which way to go. as you see the weak amount of power coming out of the plate going in the right direction, increasing, as you turn those controls on the plate resonator, you'll know when you're going in the right direction, even though you're a mile away from resonance. It'll tell you which way to go, Eric, and whether or not you're hitting resonance, whether or not that circuitry of resonation of the plate circuit got damaged by that lightning bolt. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Question, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
Is it possible they have a dummy load to try on that unit? Maybe, I'm sure I thought of that, but they switched over to a dummy load, you might be able to do a little better.
Yeah, was the antenna damaged with the lightning bolt, and therefore you can't hit resonance for that reason. So, there's various ways, by directional coupling, sampling, and the transmission line, you'll start to see the power output increase as you go in the direction of resonance. And by the way, if there really was a directional coupler, and even though the power output is supposed to be 3,000 watts, and you're only seeing 30 watts, if the 30 watts is going forward and 25 watts is coming back, that's going to tell you right away something funny is going on in the antenna. So there's ways you can get super sensitivity, even though you're not getting anywhere near resonance or the right amount of power output. But it'll still tell you when things are going in the right direction, Eric. K2EJ, K2LAW.
John, I've been doing this stuff for years. It's going into a load. We're not dealing with the antenna. Actually, the antenna's okay because the antenna is I've got a 1952 gauge running on it right now, and it's very happy. Unfortunately, it doesn't generate the kind of power that we need. It only generates 900 watts, so at least it's keeping them on the air. I've got my little DNA with me. If I were, say, to... Yeah, well, let me just put it this way. The manufacturer really didn't think about monitoring anything external of the box. But the visual detector, of course, has a directional coupler and a tap, which feeds the diodes and amplifier. I could use that with the thing powered off, and I suppose I could go that way to try and find resonance with the knobs. What do you think?
Yeah, with the amplifier turned off and you feed the amplifier backwards from its output coaxial cable with a vector network analyzer, you feed a signal back in. Because the amplifier is a constant current generator, when it's operating, it's an open circuit. It's a current generator that feeds power into the transmission line, but it is not a 50 ohm termination for the transmission line. So when you hit resonance, and you feed a vector network analyzer back into it, you're going to measure a reflection coefficient of unity, infinite VSWR. When you're out of resonance, you're going to see an infinite VSWR, complete reflection. The only thing that'll change is as you sweep through resonance, the phase angle of the reflected signal will sweep. Other than that, you're always going to see nearly unity reflection coefficient. Ain't that crazy? K2EJ, K2LAW.
It's funny, that's what I was thinking, that's why I thought I'd ask. Actually, the loading pins are the two, you know, the plates around there. Typically, I guess it's around 1700, 1800 ohms.
Absolutely not. When the tube sees 1800 ohms of load impedance, that constant current generator generates the rated power output. That's not its impedance. That's its load impedance at which it gives you the power you desire. That is not the impedance of the tube. The impedance of the tube is 10 or 20 times higher than that. You never impedance match a tetra tube. You power match it. Ain't that crazy? K2EJ, K2LAW.
I know that's crazy, that's why I asked the question. You know, but I'm looking at the thing. It took me a while to realize that. I mean, I realized it before I even got on the radio, that make sure you're thinking the right thing. Alright. You know, maybe the spectrum analyzer idea, with very little drive going into the tube, might be the answer. Because when you finally get to resonance, you'll be able to see something. Now, don't forget this. The ammeter on this thing is in. So, I'm not going to be anywhere near an amp or
even a half an amp when I finally get this thing in the right spot. So the sensitivity of the meter is too low to see that kind of stuff. So the spectrum analyzer is probably the best way to go. But then I'm going to have to tell all the control circuitry to ignore the forward power. I can do that pretty easily.
Yeah, remember to stay close enough to the mic. You're almost close enough that time. Somebody's going to have to change the gain of the audio on that transmitter, Eric. The spectrum analyzer, monitoring the power output, even though it's 10 or 20 dB lower than normal, you'll see a change when you're going in the right direction. And as you're turning those resonating controls in the plate circuit of that transmitter, and as you know which direction to go because you're watching the power slowly creep up, even though the any ampere ampmeter on the plate ain't moving yet,